Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in Intellectual History. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie. I'm a PhD student at Northwestern University. Today I'll be speaking with Lawrence Glickman, a historian and the Stephen and Evelyn Millman Professor in American Studies at Cornell University. We will be discussing his brand new book, Free Enterprise, an American History. Free enterprise is an everyday phrase that connotes an American common sense. We see it everywhere from political speeches to pop culture. Some commentators even call Christopher Columbus and the Pilgrims free enterprisers. In his new book, Free Enterprise, Glickman analyzes that phrase's historical meaning and shows just how it became common sense. Glickman traces the phrase from its many 19th century meanings, including its associations with abolitionism and free labor, to its conservative reformulation in the 1920s and 30s. It's a remarkable, deeply researched book that offers much to intellectual history, political history, and the history of capitalism. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm speaking with Lawrence Glickman about his fascinating new book, Free Enterprise. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Dexter.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the book, and I'm thrilled that we're getting a chance to talk about it. So we always start our interviews off with the same question. How did you end up becoming a historian?
Well, that's a great question. I think there's a long-term story and a shorter-term story. The long-term story is that I loved reading about history as a kid, but really had no idea that it was something you could do for a profession. And I was very lucky that my freshman year at Princeton University, I kind of as a lark took a course taught by Sean Wilentz called American Social History. And that course introduced me to all kinds of historical topics that I hadn't studied in my high school curriculum. We talked about working class history and the history of enslaved people and women's history. And it really blew my mind how history could tell the story of ordinary people from the bottom up, how there was still a lot we didn't know about history or we're just learning. And I decided to become a history major. Up until that point, I thought I would go to law school. And I remember around my junior year, I think, I asked Professor Wilentz, you know, how do you get that job that you have being a professor? And he told me, I mean, I kind of knew a little bit about graduate school, but not that much. And he told me about that. And then I decided to go to graduate school because I love the history courses I took as an undergrad. And I particularly loved researching and writing in history. And I thought it would be a great opportunity to continue that process.
Well, that's actually really lovely because Sean Wilentz is one of your blurbers for this book.
Yes. Yeah. It came full circle. I was so delighted that they asked him to do so and that he agreed to because he really was one of the people who inspired me to go into the field of history.
Well, that's fantastic. And what brought you to the topic of this book, Free Enterprise?
Yeah, that's also has a long-term and a short-term answer, I guess. The long-term answer is that the very first day I started my first job as a professor at the University of South Carolina, I remember I was unpacking boxes in my office. It was before the start of the semester. And a student came by just to introduce himself. And he said to me, don't you think the reason America is so great is because of our free enterprise system? Now, you have to keep in mind, I had just moved from Berkeley, California, only a few days earlier. That wasn't a sentence I would have ever expected to hear in Berkeley. It got me thinking about why people use that term free enterprise system, what they meant by it. And I remember asking him, although I don't remember his answer, what he meant by that term. But I kind of had it in the back of my mind that it was something that would be interesting to study. And then two things over the course of my research career, much later on, got me on the topic. The first was that when I was researching the history of consumer activism, I came across the term free enterprise in the context of 19th century abolition. Abolitionists used the term free enterprise in contradistinction to slave enterprises, that is, businesses that were dependent on the labor of enslaved people. They used the term free enterprise to talk about businesses built on free labor. And that was really one of the early uses of the term in American history in the 1830s and 40s. But then probably the main thing that spurred me to write this book is after I finished my study of consumer activism, I was working on issues of public spending and consumption. And I began to research debates about public spending in the United States in the post-war years. And one of the terms that I often found by people who opposed a public spending agenda was free enterprise. They contrasted free enterprise with public spending. That wound up being the subject of the final chapter of my book, but I didn't know it at the time, but I began to decide, I decided that studying this sort of vague but seemingly all-pervasive notion of free enterprise might be more interesting than the topic of public spending. So I kind of abandoned that topic and turned to the history of free enterprise.
Well, your book does a lot with the phrase free enterprise, and you've already kind of talked a little bit about the 19th century use of that term, but you go all the way up to the present. And the major portion of the book examines the conservative project to redefine that phrase in the early 20th century to make it more tied to things like markets and the business community. During the New Deal order to turn it into common sense.
Yes.
And I was so fascinated by this idea of common sense as almost like a historical object, you know, how actors constructed it, how it can achieve political ends. I just have a methodological question for you. How can a historian write the history of common sense?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I gave a lot of thought to that. By the way, I was very influenced by Sophia Rosenfeld's book called Common Sense, which is a wonderful treatment of the kind of intellectual history of that idea in the 18th century and into the 19th. But one of the things that frustrated me when I began grad school, which was the acme of the new cultural history, that moment, and the new cultural history, it struck me, was all about the new, the obscure, the things that, as Robert Darnton said in his book, The Great Cat Massacre, what cultural historians should study is the joke that we don't understand. And in his case, he was trying to understand why a group of Parisian artisans thought it was hilarious that they had murdered a number of cats of their mean overseer, the person who ran their shop. That was his paradigmatic example of what cultural history should do. And while I thought that was interesting, to me, there is so much buried in things that we take for granted. And I think so much of the historical project is about denaturalizing things that we take for granted, trying to understand them afresh by looking at them maybe from a different angle. Often that angle is historical. You know, when did this term come into use? What did it mean when it came into use? What were some of the debates about the meaning of a term that we don't debate anymore? this was a really important thing for me. I remember reading Peter Novick's great book on the objectivity question in American history that came out, I think, in the late 1980s. And Novick says something in his introduction along these lines as well, that he's studying something, in his case, objectivity, that we all think we understand, but that actually is super hard to define. And I kind of was influenced by that model and wanted to pursue it myself. I don't know, in answer to your specific question, if I really have a great methodological answer to your question about that. But I for me, my technique is often to look at the history of terms. You know, my first book was about the idea of the living wage, and a lot of it was sort of tracing, when did people start using this term? And isn't it significant that they started using it in the 1870s rather than, you know, I don't know, the 1840s or the 1920s? And with my work on boycotts, I was also interested in that term when it came about in 1880. And for this project, it seemed super important to do that, because people, even historians, use the term free enterprise without defining it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I wanted to go beyond that. Excuse me. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, yeah, your methodology is actually really interesting, and it seems very laborious. I mean, I was just going through the footnotes, and the amount of material that you went through for this book is just astounding. But I guess, like, when you're talking about common sense, it's so diffuse. It's it's kind of everywhere, and so. You looked for quotidian documents, I think, as you say at one point.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I wanted to do was write an intellectual history of people and ideas that, at least until recently, most intellectual historians wouldn't have been interested in, because I'm not looking at canonical thinkers. I'm looking at really people who were mostly publicists. You might even call them propagandists, mostly second order intellectuals. But I think these types of people are very influential, and they are often people who don't leave behind an archive. They might leave behind an op-ed or a sermon or a political speech. And so I thought it was my job to kind of track these things down to the extent that I could. And, I'm really lucky that I'm writing this book. I wrote this book in the last decade when, you know, so many sources are now available online that weren't available previously. Using newspaper resources was one of the central things that I did in this project.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about the argument itself now.
Sure.
And so the idea of free enterprise, became common sense. But what's really interesting about this is just how radical the idea of free enterprise actually was. For many of your actors, that meant rolling back the welfare state, rolling back, any of the New Deal provisions. And so just a really a broad sweeping question that I hope you can handle relatively quickly. How did free enterprise come to be seen as common sense?
Well, that is, to me, the $64,000 question of my book. A lot of it, I think, has to do with winning the narrative. What story is going to be compelling? And part of it, as I try to argue, was simply repetition. This term, this phrase was used over and over again, and the arguments of free enterprisers from the start of the New Deal in 1933, through the late 70s, I would say, was virtually unchanging. And so I think what happened was that an argument that first was a minority argument, because most Americans really supported the New Deal and were in favor of it. But that argument diffused into the culture, even when most Americans didn't buy it. As the New Deal became increasingly unpopular, as the New Deal coalition split apart and so forth, I think it got more purchase. and it was already familiar. You know, it wasn't like you had to make a new argument in 1973. You could make an old argument, but now it had a broader audience. And that my first chapter of the book, I decided to almost start at the end because I wrote about this document, famous among some people. I call it famous, but I realize a lot of people don't know about it.
I
called,
knew about it.
Right. I know you did, but yeah. But it's called the Powell Memo, which was a memorandum written by Lewis Powell, who was a corporate lawyer shortly to ascend to the Supreme Court only a few months later. He wrote this in August 1971. And it's called The Attack on the American Free Enterprise System. He wrote it as a confidential memorandum. Eventually, it leaked out and became public. And a lot of historians over the last 10 or 15 years have looked at it as a real turning point in American history. But my argument is actually what Powell did was really just the culmination of this four-decade-long free enterprise critique of New Deal thinking.
Great. And so what's really interesting about this new common sense that comes about in the 20th century is just how different it was from the use of free enterprise in the 19th century. And again, you've already kind of touched on how abolitionists were using this term, but I thought you could say a bit more about what a 19th century American would have meant by free enterprise.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. I would say the main thing that I observed is that for most of the 19th century, one of the dominant meanings of free enterprise was as an attribute. So a lot of politicians and city boosters and so forth would talk about unleashing the spirit of free enterprise. So free enterprise wasn't a thing. It wasn't a system as it became understood in the 20th century. It was really an attribute. And, you know, the first use I found of it, of the term, was President Andrew Jackson using the term in an address in December 1832. And he used it in that way as an attribute. And what's interesting about it was that many people, including Jackson, talked about the role of the state in helping unleash free enterprise. You know, this was the era of nation building and canals and infrastructure projects and so forth. And so it's kind of interesting because it's quite distinct from the vision that becomes dominant in the 20th century, which is very anti-statist. This vision of free enterprise included a place, at least many people who used it, included a place for kind of robust state involvement as consistent with and symbiotic even with the spirit of free enterprise.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and that is just so different than the reformulation in the 20th century, at least a conservative reformulation, where they're almost enemies. The state and free enterprise are these enemies locked in combat.
Exactly.
Can
I just follow up with one thing about that?
Yeah.
One observation that I had about this is that the terms free enterprise and free labor were important in the 19th century, but free enterprise was sort of a subset of the broader free labor ideology. They were kind of closely related to each other. One of the things I observed is that in the 20th century, they flipped and many more people spoke about free enterprise with free labor being a part of the broader free enterprise system, but definitely a subordinate part. Whereas in the 19th century, it was really flipped that free enterprise was sort of an attribute that free laborers had. It was an attribute of a healthy free labor system. And because free enterprise in the 20th century became much more associated with, say, entrepreneurs and small business firms than with individual laborers, I thought that flipping was telling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's very telling, and it tells a lot about just U.S. history more broadly. The decline of the working class, this ideological endorsement of capitalism. It's a really important reversal. So I want to talk about this reformulation. There are several people who you cover in this book who are involved in reformulating this idea of free enterprise. But one person that I think might be a good window onto these changes is Merle Thorpe, the editor of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's In-House magazine. And so he's someone that you write about a fair amount in the earlier chapters. And so how did this guy help modify the meaning of free enterprise?
Yeah, I think Thorpe is really important. One of the things I expected to find when I began to research this was that the kind of modern notion of free enterprise, which arose in the 20th century, my guess was that it emerged in contradistinction to the New Deal, which it certainly flourished in that period, but it actually emerged about a decade earlier in the 1920s. And I think Merle Thorpe was one of the key people who was, the editor, as you mentioned, of Nation's Business, this very important journal of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And I think he was one of the key people, not the only person, but sort of rethinking free enterprise. And he was one of the people who helped shift it from the idea of this attribute that, you know, individuals in a healthy free labor society possessed to a quality of the business firm, and particularly the organized business community. He introduced so many elements that became sort of standard part of free enterprise ideology a little bit later on. But when he did it, he was really, I think, formulating something new, such as the idea that even though he valorized the entrepreneur and the small businessman and so forth, he also talked about the need for business to unite and to kind of work in concert with each other through lobbies like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, for example, as a way of promoting their interests in society.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting moment, because it's almost like this like growing class consciousness among business elites, and it's this other feature of the marketplace. And so, you know, you have this competition between capitalists, but then you also have this collaboration at a political level. And free enterprise is kind of like an ideological touchstone for that. So, the New Deal is another big part of this book. And you were just talking about how this reformulation what happened before the New Deal. But you make another argument in the book that the New Deal order and the age of free enterprise shouldn't be seen as like distinct epochs. We shouldn't see it as like the New Deal order followed by the conservative backlash, that we need to think of these things as united in some sort of a dialectic. Can you walk readers through this bold historiographical point?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I think that, I'm certainly not the only historian to say this, but ever since I think 1989 book edited by Steve Fraser and Gary Gerstle called The Rise and Fall of the New Deal Order, I think there's been this conception of a kind of neatly packaged periodization in which you have the New Deal reigning hegemonic. Now, people differ on when that ended, began, say, with the election of Franklin Roosevelt. In their book, they say it died with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980. Other historians have said, no, it really died in 1968 or 1971 or what have you. And I guess while I really, I think that work is super important, and I use the concept of the New Deal order a lot, I think it's really important to not overemphasize the degree to which the New Deal order kind of reigned unchallenged, because from the very beginning, there were very serious challenges to the New Deal, which shaped it in fundamental ways. And so the way I think about it is that free enterprise always needs an other. And for most of its history, at least in the modern sense, the other for free enterprise was the New Deal. and they were, you know, had different amounts of relative strength at different times. But free enterprise challenges to the New Deal were important throughout, even the 30s and 40s, you know, periods that we think of as, you know, the high point of New Deal consensus in American history. But conversely, I think it's also the case that, say, in the, you know, what Sean Wilentz calls the age of Reagan, the period after the election of Ronald Reagan, when conservative ideas seem dominant, I think it's important to realize that the New Deal order, New Deal concepts are still vying with the conservative ones, which, you know, became dominant, but again, were never unchallenged. So I guess the way that I think about it is as a constant tension with different levels of power, but that the two have to be looked at in relation to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the free enterprisers almost gained their power from this, like, this sense of being under siege. This is like a common trope in the book, that, you know, you have these you know, business leaders, these people that are extremely powerful. They operate you know, corporations, or you also have you know, small businessmen. And they just like constantly feel like they're existentially threatened. And you call this elite victimization. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I think it's really important. One of the things that I was surprised to find is that free enterprise, which I guess when I started this project, I thought of it mostly in its economic register and maybe a little bit in its political register, but what I discovered in my book was that you really need to think about the psychological register and the idea of powerful people feeling bereft and victimized, and that they're about to lose a struggle and that it's an existential war, is something that is absolutely essential to free enterprise discourse. You know, one of the things, I just did a tweet storm today about the idea of free enterprise being under attack, because Senator David Perdue recently posted a tweet saying free enterprise was under attack. And what I showed is that pretty much any decade since the 1930s, you can find dozens of people saying that. There's really no point when free enterprise isn't under attack. Almost definitionally, what it required was a feeling that the situation was dire and desperate. And I think that explains so much about our political vocabulary and the way in which as you kind of said in introducing this, what might not at first make sense, like why would powerful, wealthy people who were doing well even under the New Deal, why would they feel so threatened? But threatened they were, at least they felt that way. And I think that that was really central to their, to the power of their message, was that it wasn't simply sort of a rational set of claims. It was a deeply emotional set of claims. And it was a set of claims about people being bereft, being aggrieved, being in danger of being wiped out in some sense.
Yeah. Do you have an example of someone, a particularly histrionic one, maybe?
Well, I think, you know, the kind of urtext of this, I think, is Lewis Powell's memo that I spoke of earlier. And you have to remember, as I try to say in the book, Lewis Powell, even though a lot of people who look at the Powell memo and say it's such an extremist document, it's a blueprint for the corporate takeover of America and so forth, but Lewis Powell was, you know, considered himself to be a very moderate personality. But he said in that document that, you know, the hour is late. You know, free enterprise is in danger and the hour is late. I think that was something like the last line of the memo. So this was 1971. Richard Nixon was the president. There had been some, you know, a wave of kind of consumer and regulatory legislation in the late 60s, early 70s. There was the EPA and so forth. But it doesn't strike me as a historian that capitalism was in tremendous danger at that point. But that's what Powell wrote, and that's what he felt. And so, you know, that's only one of about a million examples I can give you. Another one is Ronald Reagan's speech against Medicare, which he gave in the early 1960s. And, you know, he had a famous line in there about how if we don't stop this now, our children and our children's children will not know the taste of freedom and will be the last people to have experienced what freedom means. I'm paraphrasing here, but he said something along those lines. And what's interesting to me about this discourse is that the predictions are always wrong, but that doesn't stop the next set of predictions from happening when the next threat is, you know, is assessed. And so there's kind of, there's almost an endless loop quality to this.
Yeah, that really comes through in your book. The rhetoric of free enterprise seems to just be fixed. And so you have, you know, tons of changes between 1930 and the 1970s, but the rhetoric seems to almost just be stagnant.
Yeah, and I would say that was a huge challenge for me historiographically, because we are taught as historians, as you know, to look at change over time. And what I was finding was really a shocking lack of change over time in terms of the structure of the rhetoric, some of the exact same vocabulary. You know, like, for example, free enterprise is under attack. As I said, you could find that phrase word for word, you know, in every decade between the 30s and today. So what I realized, one of the things I say in the book is that although the text didn't change very much, the context changed a lot. And so that's, I think, one of the ways that I try to address this issue of change over time with a discourse that was really, as a, you know, kind of frozen in amber almost once it developed. And it was really a challenge for me as a historian. I wasn't used to that. I wasn't expecting that. And I didn't quite know what to do with it, because I thought maybe I'm failing as a historian if I'm not finding change over time. That's what we're paid to do, after all.
Yeah, no, but I think that continuity is just as important. And I think that you ended up organizing the chapters along thematic lines. I think that was the way to go.
Oh, well, yeah. Glad you thought so. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I decided to approach that issue. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to continue sort of like deconstructing this ideology. And so, yeah, we have this elite victimization. But this other aspect of it that's really interesting is just how free enterprise was basically an invented tradition. You know, we have tons of actors in your book talking about how the founding fathers and even Christopher Columbus were free enterprisers.
Yes.
So do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I mean, ever since Eric Hobsbawm introduced the term in the early 80s, I think, you know, I think historians have been very interested in the idea of invented traditions and to look at their power. And I think free enterprise is a really good example, because as I tried to show, it was a term that really wasn't used that often. It was used, you know, in these various ways in the 19th century, but really took off after the New Deal. And yet people kept talking about the golden age of free enterprise in the past, sometimes in the distant past, you know, with the Pilgrims or with, as you mentioned, Columbus, or certainly with the founders. So it was a way of reading present political struggles into the past and sort of trying to find legitimation in history. And what helped these people, and we may talk about this more later on, but was that the term was very poorly defined and very vague. And so, you know, you could get away with that and what exactly did it mean to say that the founders believed in free enterprise? They never used the term. But when you are floating the term that often and are making it common sense, then, you know, it's possible to make claims like this. And they repeatedly did, drawing on the lessons of history as they invented it, really.
Yeah, let's talk about the sort of like the definitional crisis. So you open up that chapter with a really fascinating anecdote about I forget the guy's name. Is it DeWitt Emery?
Emery, the president of the National Small Business Association.
And so his son has to write an essay, which is apparently a really common essay question on free enterprise. And then this spins off into a nationwide definitional crisis over free enterprise. Do you want to just say something quickly about that?
Sure. I love that story because his son was a high school student and had to write a paper about free enterprise. And DeWitt Emery said to his son, "Well, I could tell you because I'm, you know, my job is to promulgate the idea of free enterprise. But why don't you go to the library and look it up yourself?" And the kid goes to the library and they can't find a definition anywhere. The next day, DeWitt Emery sends his secretary to the Chicago Public Library, second largest library in the country, and three reference librarians are looking all day and they can never find a definition. And DeWitt Emery writes a column, and this is in October 1948, about, you know, the definitional crisis that you know, this term is fundamental to American history, but the most basic reference books that we have, encyclopedias and dictionaries, don't even define this. And we really need to get those publications to do this. And we need to kind of make sure that we have a ready definition for this term. And that follows only a few years earlier in 1943, during the war, there was a Gallup poll that showed that only 3 in 10 Americans could define free enterprise. And as I try to show, periodically, there were these crises, this what I call the free enterprise freakout, where people who were charged with promoting the term and arguing that it was a very basic American common sense would suddenly discover that actually nobody really knew what it meant. And even the dictionaries weren't defining it. This was a major thrust of free enterprise advocates, I would say for about 10 years from the late 30s through the late 40s before they ultimately give up on the project. And there were some very interesting offshoots, free enterprise definition contests and the like, none of which really work.
Yeah, no, I really like the chapter's use of, again, these really quotidian documents and evidence. The fact that, you know, like you read at the beginning that it was actually a really common essay question, you know, like what is free enterprise? And then again, the definition contest, it really does show kind of like the breadth of this free enterprise ideology.
Yes, I agree.
Great. So I want to move on to the Cold War. You know, you have the business community organizing themselves around free enterprise in response to the New Deal. And then you have this big communist state, you know, emerging from the Second World War as the US's primary rival. And so actually, I did an interview recently with Jay Sexton, and he said it was basically the you know, it was almost custom designed to spark feelings of nationalism and unity and all that sort of thing. But I'm wondering how this new geopolitical context changed the free enterprise movement or ideology?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that I guess I struggled with a little bit there is that free enterprise discourse was so much about the threat of internal subversion and much less about the threat of Soviet communist takeover. So I think the structure of it was that the Cold War was really important because it raised concerns about socialism and communism and the need to fight them. But what strikes me about, and often free enterprises were quite explicit about this, is that they really thought that the path to totalitarianism was the slippery slope path of expanding the welfare state, you know, what Hayek called the road to serfdom. From my angle, I mean, it's not like I want to understate the role of the Cold War. I think it's obviously super important as context, but I was surprised at the degree to which the concern was that the United States might slip into some form of socialism of its own accord without really being aware of the repercussions. And you often find things people saying, well, it's much more likely we're going to follow the British model. You know, this is in the years after the war when at least socialist government is expanding, you know, national health and this sort of thing. And there seems to be a lot of concern that the United States might follow that model. And I guess I see less explicit concern with, you know, Soviet adventurism, for example, than you find in a lot of Cold War rhetoric and other aspects of American life and American diplomacy.
I do think that is actually interesting that it plays less of a role than you find in other books, and I think it does say a lot about the business community's concerns.
Yeah, I think so, and you know, it could be that I maybe I wasn't looking in the right places, but the places where I was looking, what I was finding was this concern that the welfare state was a wolf in sheep's clothing or a Trojan horse or pick your metaphor, had a teleology that was very dangerous. And that seemed to be much more the concern than, you know, the specific threat of the Soviet Union.
And so another chapter that you have near the end of the book is on Leonard Reed's essay, I, Pencil. And it's something that I actually hadn't heard of before, and so I was really interested in it. And so this is a fairy tale autobiography of a pencil. And, it depicts the, the miracles of the marketplace, as, Ronald Reagan would say. And so it ends up becoming really influential in the libertarian and just, like, I guess, a right-wing movement. Can you share with listeners what this essay was doing and why it mattered?
Yeah, it turns out to be a really influential essay. And in fact, my children in New York State, there's a required economics course that they have to take in high school. And one of my kids had to read it for that class. It was one of the first documents they read. So it's often, it's still pretty widely assigned and read. I have a niece who attended George Mason University and read the essay in a class on kind of economic thought there. So it's not an essay that everyone has necessarily heard of, but a lot of people have come across it. And it's also very, very frequently plagiarized by columnists who aren't necessarily aware that Leonard Reed wrote a specific essay, but who follow the model of the essay, which is essentially about, as you said, the miracle of markets. And Reed's point is that no one person can make a pencil and that no planner could produce a pencil. The pencil is the result of millions of actions by individuals that are coordinated only by the price system in the market. And Reed's whole point is that this is a miracle akin to miracles of nature. It's a really kind of nice distillation of free enterprise thought, because it's his essay is anti-statist without being explicitly so, because he doesn't really focus on what the state does badly. He focuses on what markets do beautifully and miraculously that no state could possibly do. And it was a very important essay. It was written in 1958, right when sort of the libertarian movement was becoming popular and was, very highly regarded by those people as sort of just a couple of pages long, but kind of put the beauty of markets in this fable. And I think what a lot of people liked about it was that, you know, there was this idea that free market conservatives, you know, didn't really care about morality or beauty. They were just utilitarian, and Reed's whole essay has a very religious quality to it that I think a lot of people liked.
Mm-hmm.
Almost a mystical quality.
Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting is that, and you put this in the book, that he would agree with Barack Obama's famous statement, you know, you didn't build that, you know, you entrepreneurs didn't build those roads, those bridges. And he would actually agree, because he's saying that, like, no, you know, individual heroic capitalist is going to, do everything that it takes to make this pencil and then get it to the market. It's actually the marketplace, the marketplace's like spontaneity and, interdependence that produces that pencil and gets it to you.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. I think someone else called Reed's vision free market communitarianism. Mm. And it really is, the idea that, when in the 2012 Republican convention, which had this theme, yes, we built that and so forth, that really went against Reed's idea, which is that, you know, no person is an island and that we are very interdependent, but that interdependence is really manifested best and most sort of organically through market relations. And so, yeah, so at the end of that chapter, I sort of contrast and compare, because there are, as you said, there's a lot of similarities between that famous "you didn't build that" speech by Obama and also a similar speech given, I think, in 2011 by Elizabeth Warren, that both of which were heavily attacked by conservatives.
Yeah, so I want to get back to the current moment and its relation to this longer history of free enterprise. But before we get there, something that your book does really well is, obviously is focusing mainly on the conservative meaning of free enterprise, but you also leave a lot of space for these alternative meanings that people assign to the phrase. And so, you do that in the 19th century, obviously, as we've already talked about. But then you also talk about it in relation to the civil rights movement and even, like labor and unions in the 20th century. And so how did civil rights activists and unions claim free enterprise, and why were they less successful than their conservative counterparts?
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting parts to me. One of the things that I, saw right away is that Franklin Roosevelt was unwilling to cede the term free enterprise to his critics. He would say, well, I'm actually, I believe in free enterprise more than my critics do, and I'm saving free enterprise and so forth. And so there was kind of a liberal progressive strain of free enterprise thought. But what was really interesting was in the 40s and 50s into the 60s, a number of people in the labor movement and also the civil rights movement tried to do this sort of rhetorical jujitsu to reclaim the idea of free enterprise. From the point of view of the civil rights movement, a lot of it had to do with the fact that things like restrictive covenants that wouldn't allow a person to sell their house to an African-American family, for example, civil rights leaders would say, how is that free enterprise? You know, that's a violation of free enterprise. And there were major debates about the rights of sellers to determine who their audience should be, who their customers should be, with civil rights activists saying what free enterprise means is the freedom of the consumer to buy what she wants. And with people like Lester Maddox, the segregationist governor of Georgia, who had a chicken restaurant took a stand there because he said he was defending free enterprise by choosing his customers and not selling his product to African Americans, this became sort of a flashpoint on what the meaning of free enterprise was. Was it the right of producers and owners to determine their customer base, or was it the right of consumers to purchase freely? And so this was a kind of a surprising strand of civil rights language that I tried to unearth here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it points to how the phrase free enterprise doesn't have to be anything. Like the words themselves are so vague that they can be co-opted by different groups for different reasons.
Exactly, and just in regard to labor, I wasn't surprised at all that conservative labor leaders in the American Federation of Labor used the term free enterprise a lot. That didn't surprise me. But I was, a little bit surprised that Walter Reuther, who was kind of your, kind of quintessential left-leaning labor leader, the head of the United Auto Workers and kind of the person most associated probably with the left-wing social democratic side of the labor movement, used the term all the time. Again, contrasted what he thought kind of working class vision of free enterprise meant versus, say, a corporatist vision of free enterprise meant. So I think you're exactly right that it's sort of a vague term that can contain a lot of different meanings. And for most of its history, those meanings were heavily debated.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the present. You finish the book with an epilogue that has a really fascinating reading of Donald Trump and his relation to free enterprise. One might assume that this, capitalist, businessman who ends up in the White House would feel strongly about free enterprise, but he hardly ever uses that phrase, and he doesn't really express much sympathy for the underlying ideas. Can you talk about how Trump understands free enterprise, or understands, his businesses and his power, and also how his rise to power fits into your overarching narrative?
Yeah, it's very interesting, because one of the things I do is look at presidential platforms, and going back to 1936, which was the first campaign post New Deal, the Republican platform was always larded with free enterprise versus the New Deal as a major theme. And even as late as 2012, when Mitt Romney ran for president, he said free enterprise was on trial, and it was a central theme in the platform of 2012. Donald Trump really doesn't use the term very often. In fact, I think I've only found one time when he actually used the phrase, and it barely appeared on the 2016 platform. And I think Donald Trump, he's a very un-Reaganist figure in that he never talks about things like the miracle of free markets. I think Trump is a much more personalistic capitalist. And so he thinks of markets as a place where you screw your enemies over and you kind of take advantage of your connections and so forth. And that's, of course, how he operated in the New York real estate world. So there's no sort of mystique of the market in Donald Trump's worldview. It's a really very much a, there's no mysticism of the Leonard Reed type about what markets can do. So in that sense, Trump is really marks quite a contrast with this very long tradition going back to Herbert Hoover on the Republican side, in which you pay obeisance to that idea above all. But as I try to show the other side of it, which we talked about a little bit earlier, the psychological register, the feeling of bereavement and loss, I think there's no better embodiment of that side of elite victimization that characterizes free enterprise than Donald Trump. He is really, that's sort of his specialty. To talk about how people are being screwed over, and that there is this tremendous feeling of we're losing in this unfair contest and so forth. So I think he embodies the emotional, psychological side of that language, much less than the economic side of it. And the two had previously been married together. I think he's taking them apart a little bit. And it is interesting, however, that already as the 2020 election emerges, we're seeing more language in keeping with the older Republican free enterprise rhetoric, with already a lot of leading Republicans are saying our 2020 theme will be free enterprise versus socialism. And even Trump, he hasn't used the term free enterprise, but he has sketched out, the anti-socialist theme is going to be central to his campaign. Several other leading Republicans have said similar things. So I think we're at an interesting moment in free enterprise discourse.
Yeah, to say the least. It's definitely interesting. So we always conclude our programs with a question about what our guests are working on now.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm working on two projects, which may turn into one. One is a history of backlashes in America. One of the things that has I've noticed in the study of backlashes is that we tend to view them as discrete events. And one of the things I'm trying to do is say, partly based on the research I did for the Free Enterprise book, is that it seems like backlash is much more a basic fundamental condition of American politics rather than an exceptional period of politics, which is how we often think about it. So I'm trying to think about backlashes in sort of a long durée framework, maybe going back to Reconstruction. And so that's kind of one side of what I'm researching. And the other thing I've been looking at is the, which may seem unrelated, but I think it really connects up to it, which is looking at the Democratic Party and liberalism in general in the period of the 1970s and 1980s, when the New Deal order seemed to be collapsing, and how they tried to revive or maybe even abandon New Deal liberalism in this period. And so I've been interested in looking at the both the symbolic but also the policy side of the legacy of the New Deal in the period when the New Deal, for many Democrats, no longer seemed necessarily a compelling or even a relevant model. And the reason why the latter relates to the former, I think, is that what I'm discovering is so much of the fear among liberals and Democrats in that period was the fear of setting off a backlash. If we go too far in defense of New Dealism at a time when it's not particularly popular, we're going to face the wrath of voters. And so we need to be very careful not to do that. And so I'm finding a lot of sort of preemptive moves to avoid the possibility of facing a backlash.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's almost like a proto, this is why we got Trump, line of thinking. Those projects both sound really interesting, and I'm super excited to see if they converge or diverge. Until then, I really want to thank you for speaking with me today, Larry. It was a fantastic conversation.
Well, thanks so much, Dexter. I really enjoyed it.
And the book is Free Enterprise and American History by Lawrence Glickman. It is being published today as we're speaking. You've been listening to New Books in Intellectual History.